Welcome to Fire Your Therapist, a podcast with a radical perspective on mental health. Here are your hosts, Carrie and Dan.
Welcome to Fire Your Therapist. On this show, we're going to see how many access to diagnoses Carrie has.
We'll be here a while.
Really? That many?
That many.
That many.
Yeah. You know, I heard there are no more axes.
There aren't. It's true.
What's the point of that?
I think the point of that was they wanted to destigmatize some diagnoses. They wanted to put it all on sort of, I don't remember what they're calling it, a continuum of functioning, a continuum of development, something like that.
Huh. What are we going to do with ourselves if we don't know how to label each other?
Well, don't worry. There is still personality disorders.
Oh, phew.
And there are still cluster A and cluster B.
Wow, good.
So just because they're not under their own axis of the diagnosis, they're still there.
Okay.
You just don't have any axes. You can give people as many diagnoses as you want. They're just all...
Excellent.
It's one big section.
I thought without all the diagnoses that I wouldn't even know how to understand the people in my life anymore if I don't have a name for them.
Totally. Totally, yeah. Without labeling and without good stereotypes, I don't know how I'd make sense of this world.
Right.
Yeah.
Dan, on this episode, I want to talk about why we diagnose.
Should we... Okay, we can do that. But should we also explain to people what the heck we were just talking about?
Well,
axes,
yeah.
One and two, like...
Okay.
This is very insider language. Should we explain what this means?
Why don't we check in with your anxiety around... people not understanding the axes and how all you right. just
so
want to support
scorecard
them.
Scorecard for the show, Carrie 1, Dan 0. I've been diagnosed with anxiety.
Excellent. I'm going to write these down.
Oh, we'll see how many diagnoses we have by the end of the show.
Dan, generalized anxiety disorder.
Because
you're generally anxious about disorders. Go ahead.
Are we checking in?
Yeah.
Oh.
Your turn. You're on.
My check-in is that I don't like talking about diagnoses, but I do like talking about personality disorders. Isn't that interesting?
Well, is it because you used to be one?
Zing!
Nobody seen Mrs. Doubtfire? All right.
No.
I don't work with the males. Because I used to be one.
Oh,
I don't remember Robin Williams.
I get what you're
doing. It's a famous line.
Right.
All right.
Anywho. I have nothing else to check in about.
So you're checking in about you don't like talking about diagnosing, you like talking about personality disorders. That's interesting.
I actually know why that is too, but we can get to that later.
Okay. That's exciting. I'm going to check in with I hate diagnoses. I don't hate many things. That's something that I hate. And I hate it because it's oppressive. And I hate it because it changes the power dynamic between a practitioner and a client. And because it impacts people's lives down the road. And there's a whole system set up for diagnosing people that can actually be made public in certain regards if you're a practitioner. So anyway, it's a whole system I disagree with. So I'm going to put that out at the beginning that's where I'm coming from in this episode. It'll be quite plain that I'm not interested in talking about why we diagnose as much as I'm interested in talking about why we shouldn't diagnose.
Well, I'm sure we can do both.
Yeah.
Maybe more of the latter, but
yeah,
we'll see how it goes.
I think that it might be jarring for people to hear that I practice psychotherapy and I disagree with diagnosing. And I know that the Board of Behavioral Sciences is going to test me to ensure that I can accurately do so, which I'm going to have to be able to do, or at least prove that I'm able to do.
Right.
But I think it's useless in almost every scenario. There are very few places in which I think it's useful. So why do we diagnose? What do you think? We're just going to throw out ideas.
Well, I think one of the basic premises of diagnosis was to give people a shared language.
Uh-huh. Who? What people?
Anybody working in the field of psychology.
But who was listening that didn't understand what an axis was? So I don't know how shared it is.
Well, if you're listening and you don't know what an access is, you're probably not a therapist or otherwise in the field of psychology. But
right, but that's the power dynamic I'm talking about. The diagnosing, right. it's really only for practitioners. But
we didn't invent diagnoses for people that aren't practitioners.
Wait, say it again.
It's a shared language for practitioners, yes. Not for the public.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And it is exclusive and it is disempowering that most people may or may not know how much that impacts their life, their medical records, wherever those diagnoses get used. But
if I worked in a wellness center or mental health clinic and I was required by law, because of where the funding came for that paid my paycheck, if that funding required me to diagnose, how much time am I allowed with a client before I have to decide what they are?
I think it depends on the site, but usually in like 4 to 6 sessions, you're kind of expected to have at least a provisional diagnosis ready. There's probably some horrible, horrible places to work where you get 1 hour to come up with a diagnosis, but that seems unreasonable.
I know there's a provisional part where you can say, I think it's this provisional, and then you have the authority to change it.
Right.
But there's a time frame in which you can. And a lot of people can be diagnosed with things that are short-lived or thought of in a way that can be overcome. And then there are a set of diagnoses that are thought to not be able to be overcome, which is something that's been very, heavily stigmatized in the past. And we have, even like the general public is going to understand some of those things. We refer to things like narcissism, borderline personality disorder, things that have these very aggressive names.
Right. Well, that goes back to what I said in my check-in about how I don't much like talking about diagnoses, but I love talking about personality disorders.
Yeah.
And it's partially because of what you just said, that they are so rigid and so unchanging and that they were so stigmatized. Mm-hmm. And the rest of the diagnoses, honestly, in my opinion, are the product of some contextual experience. So to give it a label, I think, just vilifies and shames, the most reasonable product to come out of a certain contextual experience. Mm-hmm. But personality disorders are really interesting because the impact of whatever context related to it left it so rigid.
Left the person's working models of the world so rigid.
Right, mm-hmm. Right. Left their strategies for engaging with the world mm-hmm. also so rigid that they do stand apart in many ways from a lot of other diagnoses in a way and become really interesting to look at the dynamics of them. And they're on a spectrum too. I mean, I say what I just said, but also I truly believe that anybody and everybody, if your resources are limited enough, and I don't just mean money, I mean money, food, rest, support, relationships, everything.
Right.
Right. If you are pushed to the wall into survival mode, we will all emerge as narcissists, borderlines, like antisocial personality. Just we will all come out as all of those.
Absolutely.
If we are spread thin enough. So I just want to say that I do see it on a continuum no matter what. These aren't like different types of people. I don't want anybody to think of them as some vilified, shameful type of person.
Yeah,
but it's still interesting. The patterns that emerge are still really interesting to me.
The way what I heard in what you said was that under certain conditions, anyone would become a narcissist. Under certain conditions and a certain context and certain lack of resources or certain amount of worldly pressure, you could become bipolar, depressed, borderline. These things that that we've come to known as something that is a part of a person, I guess. That's the stigma part I'm talking about is if I call myself borderline or I say I have borderline personality disorder. On one hand, I know that when someone gets a diagnosis that it can feel very freeing because it's like, oh, that's what I've been struggling with all this time. It's something that's going on in my brain or in my chemistry or in my makeup. And it's something I'm going to have to deal with. Like, a lot of people think of depression in that way. But on the other hand, someone else in your situation would be labeled the same thing if they had gone through what you've gone through.
Right.
But there's one piece of diagnosing that I want to sort of make clear that I see very differently, and I'm assuming you would too, Dan, is that when there's some sort of thing happening in the brain that is actually outside of context. So if I was born with a brain defect, or if I had a brain injury from an accident, and how things can become rigid in that way, that's very different than a developmental mind, you know, mindset.
Sure. I think that's a good point, but I would still say that every brain, every body, everything is on some sort of continuum of what organic factors are there or not there. Everything from neurotransmitter levels to, you know, the diet and rest and general health of the mother while you were in the womb. Like, right. There's so many little factors that influence those things that while I do agree with you that those play such an extreme role, mm-hmm. That they kind of stand out, they are extreme versions of things that are already on a continuum.
That's true.
And I just don't want anybody to think that there is some baseline normal mm-hmm. and then some abnormal. Instead, there's a spectrum, and when it hits the extremes is when it gets really easy to label as something.
Yes.
It's not that they are binary categories.
And that's where it comes back to what you were saying about having a common language. So when I say, oh, I have a client with autism, that's a shorthand for what I'm seeing show up every week.
Right.
So another practitioner could very quickly and easily understand what it is I'm, you know, probably doing in my work with them and what they may or may not be struggling with. But that's also a drawback, because now, Dan, if I told you I had a client with autism, based on your contextual preconceived notions of what autism is, you can assume what my client is like and ignore a whole spectrum of individual idiosyncrasies about that person. And I think that that's when we start to set it up as that more rigid scheme, right. But from the practitioner standpoint.
Right. Right. Well, I think there's two bits at play there. And I think that's, that tunnel vision that we get when we're just looking at the diagnosis and not the rest of the person is a big issue. The other thing at play is that the common language that we've created was only partially really designed to be a common language, and also partially designed to be something that made medical and insurance industries have a really easy time keeping track of things.
Uh-huh.
You know, so it's sort of both at play at once. So, and that's why I think both of us have a bit of a dislike for diagnosis, because outside of these more extreme cases where the common language really does give you shorthand for a ton of information that would be very hard to convey. And I think, honestly, that's maybe 10 to 20% of the time. I'm just throwing out a number,
mm-hmm.
a small portion of the time. The rest of the time, I don't think that common language, that diagnosis covers nearly enough for someone to do good work taking over just based on the diagnosis, right? So let's use a really common diagnosis like depression. Shows up for so many different people who have such radically different lives. And just a few years into this profession, I see people whose depression comes out of something that counterbalances with a lot of anxiety versus something that counterbalances trauma versus something that comes from just, you know, consistent overwhelm and then goes into lethargy, right? And they're totally different.
Yeah, right? And that a male versus female sense of depression looks very different too, because of the way that we've been socialized into different gender roles.
Culture.
And how absolutely thrown off that can be when you start talking about people that were not raised in a traditional gender role or don't identify with a traditional gender role. Now, how is the practitioner actually going to look at what depression is and how you're going to tick off your little boxes of, oh, you have this symptom, this symptom, this symptom, and it shows up differently in everyone.
Right.
And every symptom is on a spectrum as well.
Exactly. And in those are the cases where I think the diagnosis language, even though we call it a common language, actually does a disservice.
Yeah. Because we're assuming it's common.
Right. Right. And honestly, the majority of the time when a new clinician asks me, hey, I'm getting transferred a client from somebody else, should I review their diagnosis and their case file? I usually suggest no.
Yeah.
I say, give yourself a few months to get to know that person.
Right.
And then go back and look. If you feel you even need to, you know, depending on the situation, sometimes you might never, ever need to. Sometimes, and this is really going to be possibly radical for a lot of our listeners, I would ask the client, hey, do you want me to review your file from that past therapist? Or would you rather we just left it as history and started from scratch? It's their case file. Why not give them some influence over how we use it?
There you are being transparent and inclusive. How dare you?
I'm so relational.
I really, really, really want to not skip over this one idea. The stakeholders of a diagnosis. And I mentioned earlier, if I worked at a mental health facility that was funded by the state, let's say, or by the Department of Mental Health, and how that changes the, well, I guess just to speak to maybe a general public listener, that do they know that the Department of Mental Health has a hand in diagnosing? And when it comes to providing like insurance money, there are certain diagnoses that warrant more or less support from mental health services.
Right.
And so if I diagnose something, someone with something that is more, I don't know, ingrained or long-term or something that is seen as something that's more difficult to overcome, that the services required for that are going to be more of a strain on an insurance company than someone who's going through, I don't know, transitional, you know, anxiety. Right. Right. Oh, I just went away to college and I'm away from my support network and I'm feeling a little sad. And how an insurance company is more likely to want to put money towards that because they know it might be short-lived.
Right.
So is there anything that you can speak to on that topic, Dan, of what, you know, what your opinions are or stories you've heard or any anecdotes?
Well, it's a highly politically charged issue because, you know, on the one side of it, I think the sort of business model that drives insurance and medicine will say, well, you know, we have to know what we can afford. We have to be able to plan for what we can take care of. We have to budget for, you know, what someone's going to need. We have to be able to be sure we can hold them and their insurance policy accountable for covering the care that they need. You know, there'll be that perspective. But on the flip side of it, it ends up being totally socially unjust many times because people that have the most need for support and some of the most severe diagnoses are also going to be the ones that have the least resources to pay for them.
Absolutely.
So it inadvertently sets up like a system where those folks that are getting turned down for care longer than 6 months, that are getting turned away from programs that don't like that diagnosis, are not going to get that care elsewhere.
Right. They would never be able to afford it on their own.
Right.
Especially not in the long-term way that they would need it to have any sort of sustainable life change.
Right. Exactly. And I think a model that looks more at everybody's needs is going to be different. It's all going to be on a spectrum. You know, the goal is the most equitable distribution of resources to bring those that need it into community and support and sustainability. And nobody wants to implement that model because you can't track the money as easily.
That's true. Yeah. You know, I'm becoming really curious about, I wonder if there's somebody listening right now who's been in therapy and has been diagnosed and they're sitting there thinking, huh, I wonder what it was. I wonder what the therapist wrote down. I wonder what they decided I am. And I wonder if they know that they have access to their notes.
Right. Yeah, they can like request they their have own the legal, file and
right.
it'll be given to them.
They have legal right to ask for it and not to be denied.
Yeah.
And I also wonder if they know that the diagnosis, whatever that they've been given, if it's been reported to an insurance company for reimbursement, that the insurance company does have access to that information as well. Not the notes for each session, but the diagnosis.
Yeah.
And that it will follow them. I don't. I just want to know. I'm wondering if any listeners are wondering about that, and did they know that? I want to make that really clear and transparent because I don't think that is common knowledge.
Yeah.
They think I need support. I'm going to go to a therapy. You don't really think about it much after that, other than how hard it is to go every week and process emotions and feelings and all these things.
Right.
It's enough work, but do they know how political it really is on the other side? I don't think any therapist is. You know, coming from the frame of mind of, oh, I'm going to really mess their life up and give them something really drastic that's going to follow them forever. But before insurance companies were able to take you on regardless of a pre-existing condition, right? Because now they're not, at least in America, right? We're not allowed to be denied anymore.
Right.
Well, before when you were able to be denied, they would actually have access to your diagnosis first if you've ever been in the system before. So if I find out, Dan, you have a very rigid personality disorder, which obviously you do, you're a complete narcissist. But what I was going to say is that if I was in the insurance company, I wouldn't likely take you on.
Right.
Because I wouldn't have to.
Right.
Or if you're someone that I deemed to have required a lot of my support as an insurance company, I'm going to say that's not a good bet for me. I'm going to lose money on you, way too much money.
Well, and I don't think even many therapists know how much their profession, being a therapist, is packaged into the world of medical insurance.
Right.
Right. So when you go to the doctor and they diagnose your broken knee, and that goes in your medical record, you're not.
They write that down. Diagnosis: broken knee. That's so. It's so clinical.
It is clinical.
Broken. It doesn't work right.
Right. not working. Well, whatever the diagnosis is, the medical thing usually doesn't come with as much stigma.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Right.
If someone looks at your records and sees you had a knee surgery, they're not going to draw any conclusions about who you are. They're just going to see that you had a knee surgery. You must have had a knee injury.
Mm-hmm.
Right? But maybe a good comparison would be if you go to the doctor for an abortion, mm-hmm. depending what kind of community you live in, maybe that's the kind of thing that you really wouldn't want there to be a record of, right? And I think a lot of psychological diagnoses have that stigma.
Of course.
So what having if you... them in the same medical record that every insurance company looks at when they're like, oh, okay, so they got a physical, a knee surgery. Oh, diagnosed bipolar. Okay, well, we're going to up their insurance rates.
Or
going to drop them from the policy.
Admitted to the psychiatric ward for psychotic break or psychotic symptoms,
right.
Which could mean anything, really.
Right.
That's a spectrum as well.
Right.
And can look like psychotic symptoms when you're in another state of mind, actually. Anyway, it's so subjective in the first place.
Right. A minute ago, you were talking about... clients and if they knew what their diagnosis was and where that is on record. And I think one of my favorite things to do as a counselor is when a new client comes to me and says, so I used to go to therapy. I have this bipolar diagnosis or whatever it is. And so I guess I need more therapy. And one of the first things I do is say, okay, well, are you familiar with what that is? Do you know what that means, that label you were given? Well, you know, it means I'm moody or, you know, they have some colloquial story for what it means. So I bring in the DSM and sit down, we read it together and talk about what that label means. And then let them, you know, decide with me, do they really want to carry that story around with them, that that's who they are?
Well, here's the question. If they were or they weren't, would your treatment be any different?
I have to answer that question carefully because if they were or weren't might have little to do with the sort of relational and social patterns that they have in their life.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And I think my strategies for how I engage with those patterns are going to be what my strategies are from the modality I work in.
Right.
Right. In terms of like building relationship strength and cultivating support, et cetera, et cetera. Is it going to be different whether or not it has the label? Probably not for me.
I don't think it would.
But I would be looking at some of the same patterns and phenomena to decide the strategies. I just wouldn't care about the label.
Patterns and phenomena, though.
I just wouldn't care about the label.
So give me one trademark of a personality disorder. Let's say a borderline personality disorder. What's one trademark that we've learned in diagnosing?
I think one of the biggest markers in terms of behavioral patterns is an easy tendency to swing very quickly from enmeshed to very distant and detached, right? So someone can be...
I love you, I hate you,
right, exactly.
Okay, exactly. So let's say there was no borderline personality disorder, but you encountered someone that was just putting you on a real pedestal and they were worshiping and adoring who you were. They were like, Dan, you were the best therapist ever. My last therapist was rotten. They never helped me. Wow, this is my first session and this is amazing. I'm so coming back next week. And then the next week you say something and they walk out. When there's no conversation, no dialogue, you just cut off, right? So if you encountered something like that, would it necessarily matter what it was called? You'd probably respond to it in the same way. Wow, what just happened? Let's unpack.
Right.
No, wait, exactly, I'm confused. Last week it was this and this week it's this. How do you make sense of that?
Well, in both times, I wouldn't even need to know if there was a pattern.
Right.
Week to week before I could say, so you just met me. It actually doesn't make sense to call me the best therapist.
Right.
Nor would it make sense to call me the worst. So I'm just curious, like, what led to that conclusion? What, you know, what did I miss in the room that just happened that I wasn't aware of that led to that? Because that's not an actual thing. I mean, I think any therapist that relies on their confidence for what they do based on which clients tell them you're the best therapist, you should just quit now, because that's not really a measure of anything.
Not really.
You know, it's the measure of someone's emotional experience in the moment and whether it was totally focused on you. Mm-hmm. It doesn't actually mean you're doing any really good work. You could just be really selfish and narcissistic and manipulative yourself, so you get everybody to say you're great.
Do you do that, Dan? Yeah,
well, that is why I'm such a good therapist.
I'm writing down narcissist. Narcissist. How do you spell that?
I'm losing this game. That's like 2 diagnoses to 0.
I have nothing. I'm perfect.
Uh-huh.
Oh, crap. I have narcissist now. I still can't spell it. That's all right. There's a bunch of S's and C's.
So we could easily go on talking about diagnoses forever. Mm-hmm. But maybe we should wrap up. Is there anything you'd like to check out with?
Yeah, I have one thing. I mentioned earlier that, yeah, diagnosis can follow you when you're in the system. But I had a really interesting thought come back to me from when I was at university. And I had a friend who wanted to go into her own psychotherapy because practitioners who are studying, well, you're studying to become a therapist, you have an opportunity to go to your own psychotherapy and work on yourself and your own stuff. Mm-hmm. And you get incentives to do that. But if you go under an insurance company, and then your diagnosis will be, well, which is mandatory, by the way, if your insurance is paying, you must have a diagnosis. Doesn't necessarily matter what it is, but you need to have one or the insurance company won't pay. So it's not an option to not be diagnosed when you go. And I don't think that's common knowledge necessarily either for anyone who's not in the field. But so if I am studying to be a therapist and I want to go and work on myself and I have insurance, I'm going to go find a practitioner to talk to every week and tell them all my secrets, and then they diagnose me. Well, now when I become a therapist and I'm licensed, that is on my record. So what if I had some sort of a personality disorder or something? So now it's on my record. Now, yes, there's confidentiality and there are measures put in place, but there's really no saying that that's not going to get out, right? To all of my clients. Yes. And then, not that that's the end of the world, but because everybody has preconceived notions about what certain diagnoses mean, you know, it can be career ruining. So I remember having a friend who was contemplating going to get her own psychotherapy, and she said, I'm going to go to someone who will diagnose me with adjustment personality disorder, which is the mildest thing you can get. It just means you're going through a life transition. And she said, I'm paying out of pocket so it'll never be reported. So in case I ever had to go to court and they, you know, subpoenaed, is that the word, my own mental health records and they, whatever, there was just cause for them to have them, you know, nothing would come of it. I thought that was interesting that even practitioners consider the stigma that's going to be attached to them.
Well, there's a reason why so many practitioners submit adjustment disorder for their clients. It's the same thing.
It's a very sweet move to make sometimes. I don't know. I think that if I was forced to diagnose that I might feel like that's the nicest thing that I could do if I had to diagnose.
I would love it if you could write a diagnosis that said isolated, needs more community and support, period.
Isn't that Axis 4?
Right. It is
the other old social factors, which I think is the whole diagnosis, in my opinion.
Yeah.
Every social factor is what makes you, you know, get to a point where you need support and you need therapy.
Right.
When you think there's something wrong with you, there's really just something wrong in your world.
One of my favorite RSA videos, for anybody listening who doesn't know what that is, go check out.
Is it on the site?
TheRSA.org. It might be on our site too. It says, if you want to have a happier life, just go find happier friends.
We're going to put that on the site. If you want to have a happier life, go find happier friends. That's true. Yeah, look for that in the things we think you should watch section at fireyourtherapistshow.com. Dan, is there anything that you want to check out with?
I'm going to check out by saying that one of the things we have not addressed in this conversation are the implications for assessment and treatment.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's one of the biggest overlooked areas of professional training for therapists. I don't know as much about social workers or other practitioners, but definitely for therapists, assessment and treatment planning is greatly overlooked. It's not nearly enough of the education as it should be for that being the majority of what you do. And all of this education about pathology plays very little into what you actually do day to day. But I just want to throw out there that for as much as Carrie and I are dismissive of diagnosis as a foundational piece of the work, I just want to assure everybody that it is possible to assess and do treatment planning very well without that. And if anybody is in this profession and really curious about learning more about that, there happens to be a place where both of us were trained called the Relational Center that has entire curriculum on how to assess and treatment plan without relying on diagnosis. So, and I'm sure there's others out there, but I just don't want people to hear criticism of diagnosis as a dismissal of the need for good assessment and treatment planning.
Yeah, I agree. And I had one last thing that I want to add on here. I know that we've been sort of poking at the DSM and diagnosis, and like you said, Dan, we understand the historical context of where it came from. But I just wanted to throw out there that the DSM's changed so much over time, and it's changed according to how we think of the human condition. So I just wanted to share that in 1851, there was a diagnosis. It was called drapetomania. Do you know what that means, Dan?
I don't know what that means, but it's, I'm curious to hear.
It's the runaway slave syndrome. Oh. It was given to any slave that wanted to compulsively run away from their master.
That is a mental disorder. They should be medicated and treated.
Oh, right. Why would they want freedom? So strange. Mm-hmm. So I just want to throw out there that in 1851, that was where the DSM was in that day.
Right.
And it has evolved since then. So I just want to really clearly name who wrote it in the first place and how it really has been such a power dynamic of where the diagnosing came from people that thought they were normal, and they decided who was abnormal, and they gave names to those people. But what they never put in the DSM was like a diagnosis for like a white landowner who wanted to compulsively own humans. You know, that was never a diagnosis. And right. I just want to throw out that maybe it should right. be added just yep. in case anybody still wants to do that. You know, there are ways that we've started to think of the human condition and mental illness, but it comes from a very tainted place.
Yeah.
So what's being adapted is not coming from a system that we've created now. It's coming from something that was created by oppressors a long time ago.
Right.
Anyway, I thought that was really important to note.
It is. It's very interesting. Thank you for sharing that.
And it's not the only one. There are many.
I believe you.
Homosexuality, obviously, is like something that most people might know was a diagnosis.
Yeah, even up until
1973.
Yeah, I was going to say 70 something. It was gender identity disorder, I'm pretty sure.
Well, no, just homosexuality. We didn't have an understanding of accepting human sexuality. Or being romantically sexually attracted to someone of the same sex. So it had to be something wrong with our brain, right?
Right. Well, if anybody has any feedback for us on this episode or any episodes, you can email us feedback@fireyourtherapistshow.com. You can follow us on Twitter @FYTshow. You can like us on Facebook. And thank you very much for listening. We look forward to sharing with you again next week.
Fire Your Therapist was produced by Yumi Media. Subscribe to our free podcast on iTunes or go to fireyourtherapistshow.com where you can find podcasts, resources, and more.